two excerpts from Handel's Messiah and the Glory of the Lord, and bringing the first half of this Desert Island Discs prom to a rousing finish, the Hallelujah Chorus, also bringing many of the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall to their feet. Keith Lockhart conducting the BBC Concert Orchestra and the Huddersfield Choral Society. The Hallelujah Chorus has been chosen on no fewer than 41 occasions by castaways including Charles McKerris in 1975, the comedian Eric Sykes in 1997, and the historian David Starkey in 2005. Well, Desert Island Discs presenter Kirsty Young will be back on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall with more castaways in around 20 minutes. But first, it's time to join Mariella Frostrup and her guests for tonight's Proms Plus Literary event, exploring Desert Island book choices. It was recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
For a bookworm, the prospect of being stuck on a desert island with nothing but the screech of gulls and the waves lapping on the shore to distract you from your reading has much to recommend it. But once you've ploughed through your complete Shakespeare and delved deep into the Bible, what sort of choices have Desert Island Discs castaways made to pep up that literary diet? Tonight, we're going to be talking about the Desert Island book nominations over 70 years of Radio 4's iconic programme and discovering what those titles say about the castaways and the programmes themselves. To help me explore these fascinating and sometimes downright masochistic choices, from Silence of the Lambs to A Timetable of Steamers, I'm delighted to welcome the lyricist and cricket fanatic Sir Tim Rice, honoured as a castaway not once but twice, Dame Harriet Walter, an RSC stalwart and known on the small screen as D.I. Natalie Chandler in Law and Order, also a castaway, who'll be bringing some of the book choices to life. And finally, the writer Kevin Jackson, who we've cast as our literary sleuth, forensically studying the archive. Kevin, as I said, you've delved deep into the book choices over 70 years. Does anyone actually pick their favourite book?
I'm not going to suggest that anybody ever shows off on Desert Island Discs. That would be quite unthinkable in our nation. What's really seemed to emerge, I think, is that to place a good construction on it, people often choose the great big book that they haven't actually got around to reading. They think, well, I'm going to be stuck on this island for who knows how many years. It better be something big. So War and Peace is very popular. Some of the longer Dickens novels are very popular. Surprisingly popular is Gibbon, who I think very few people these days actually read for pleasure, though, in fact, if you dip into the footnotes, he's kind of fun. Overall, absolute outright winner, no question, no holds barred, is Proust.
We'll be coming to Proust in a moment, don't rush me. Okay. But Tim, you having been a castaway, not once but twice, as I pointed out, is it true that you're never trying to show off when you make your book choices? Or is there a bit of a thought about how people are going to perceive the book you choose?
I don't know. I think perhaps in my case I had a bit of reverse snobbery or reverse showing off. I chose Alice in Wonderland, or actually the complete works of Lewis Carroll first time around. Alice in Wonderland was one of my favourite books as a child, and indeed still is one of my favourite. But I wanted the complete works of Lewis Carroll because he also wrote a lot of books on mathematics and logic and calculus and all that. And I thought if you're on the desert island, you would have great fun trying to, or I would have great fun, most people probably wouldn't, trying to find how numbers worked and what they can do. And some of his puzzles and problems, I think, would have kept me happy. Second time around, I chose Molesworth, which... I do love, but it's not exactly very intellectual. I probably should have gone for Proust and impressed people. I played the game as if I were stranded. I think it's more fun doing that. And I think, I mean, Proust, I've never read a word of Proust, I'm ashamed to say.
Harriet, perhaps for Tim's benefit, you could read us a bit of Proust from À la recherche de temps perdu.
This is from The Way by Swans, Part 1, Cambrai. For a long time, I went to bed early. Sometimes, my candle scarcely out, my eyes would close so quickly that I did not have time to say to myself, I'm falling asleep. And half an hour later, the thought that it was time to try to sleep would wake me. I wanted to put down the book I thought I still had in my hands and blow out my light. I had not ceased while sleeping to form reflections on what I'd just read, but these reflections had taken a rather peculiar turn. It seemed to me that I myself was what the book was talking about. A church, a quartet, the rivalry between François I and Charles V. This belief lived on for a few seconds after my waking. It did not shock my reason, but lay heavy like scales on my eyes and kept them from realising that the candlestick was no longer lit.
What is it about that particular book, do you think? Why do people choose it?
I think it divides between those for whom it is a sort of sacred book. Proustians tend to be somewhat fanatical, and for a work which is very much about the anatomy of snobbery in many ways, I'm afraid there is a tremendous amount of snobbery attached to Proust, who, by the way, from what I've read, which is about a quarter of the whole thing, is fantastic. But, you know, it is a desert island book. I think for others it's simply that mere thing of what is the longest book I can think of? And, you know, it's very long. And I think it has that immense virtue. You think, presumably one of the things about the books, and I think people cheat when they do survival type books, you know, how to build a raft, that kind of thing. I think it's the kind of thing that makes you feel that you can live imaginatively in a completely other world. And the fact that you're there alone, and Proust's book is partly about solitude, but partly also about the experience of society, I think, you know, you would feel like you were living amongst a very rich gallery of people.
Harriet, it is a bit like writing a narrative of your life, isn't it, appearing on Desert Island Discs? Did you feel it like that? And is it hard not to try and author it as a result? You know, rock stars choosing economists, actors choosing scientists, Tracy Emin choosing Spinoza.
I couldn't be a snob about literature because, I wouldn't know where to start. I very much was torn between a book that I wanted to read that I'd heard was good but had never read, you know, like War and Peace or something, and something that I loved very much and wanted to return to for comfort. I think in one way, if I was really honest, I'd have chosen Dickens. But I didn't. I thought, I'm going to do a woman, you know, let's always promote the woman. And I also genuinely thought, you know, I'm so scared of the thought of being left alone on an island. If I chose a woman who, as I did, had been a poor little invalid in, you know, in Victorian life and had gone out and braved the world and been a fantastically adventurous traveller, she'd make me feel rather sort of okay to be alone on an island. So I said, it was rather...
Though I have to say, the passage you've chosen made me feel totally unadventurous. I mean, she really is feisty. Could you perhaps read that?
Well, she didn't start feisty. This is Isabella Bird, who was treated as an invalid most of her life and sent to Hawaii to kind of, for her health, sort of TB reasons, and then took so much to the idea of being in foreign parts that she spent the rest of her life travelling all over the world, and she was about 4 foot something. Every time she went back home to Britain, she fell ill again and lay on the sofa. So I just found her fascinating. And this is her talking about her adventures in the Rocky Mountains. I was dizzied and breathless by the pace at which we were going. A shorter time than it takes to tell, it brought us close to and abreast of the surge of cattle. The bovine waves were a grand sight. Huge bulls shaped like buffaloes bellowed and roared, and with great oxen and cows with yearling calves galloped like racers, and we galloped alongside of them and shortly headed them, and in no time were placed as sentinels across the mouth of the valley. It seemed like infantry, awaiting the shock of cavalry as we stood as still as our excited horses would allow. I almost quailed as the surge came on, but when it got close to us, my comrades hooted fearfully, and we dashed forward with the dogs, and with bellowing, roaring, and thunder of hooves, the wave receded as it came.
Well, definitely a classic and very much of its time. And the list really heavily favours classics, doesn't it, Kevin?
Very much so.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because people sort of finally think, well, I'll have the time at last to approach that great tome that I've meant to read all my life?
That's definitely true, and I think there's also the sense of the tried and tested, that nobody's particularly impressed if you've read the latest, shall we say, Shopaholic novel or something like that. But if you actually have read Gargantua and Pantagruel, people might avoid you as being a bore, but they'll be quite impressed. I did a rough estimate. I don't think there are probably more than about a dozen living writers on the list, perhaps a few more, but not many. You can see certain patterns coming out, and it's interesting kind of what gets neglected. I mean, virtually the entire 18th century, apart from Samuel Johnson, is forgotten. Pope, Swift, Burke, you name it, they're not there.
Tim, I mean, is there a sense that people want to learn something, that they want to come out of the experience having discovered something, maybe even something practical? I know Trevor Nunn picked a yoga manual, which I thought was quite a good idea, actually.
It all depends how you play the game, which applies to the music as well as the books. You can play it, just choose records and a book that have meant something to you, or you can actually choose something that you think will keep you alive and sane on the island. Sometimes the two are the same thing. I mean, I would have loved to have taken a big novel, but I thought, well, if I take the wrong one and I don't like it, I'm safer with Lewis Carroll or Molesworth. And interestingly, with people like Proust and, you know, Tolstoy, all, I mean, presumably it depends on which translation you get, because I would imagine Proust has been translated brilliantly and badly. So you've got to know which version to get, unless you want to try and read it in the original French, which actually would be quite interesting because that would occupy a lot of time. But then you need a French dictionary. It's
getting quite complicated, yes. Isn't it? But let's move on to someone that I presume people are choosing in translation, because otherwise the intellectuals on Desert Island Discs are even more intellectual than we ever imagined. Dante's Divine Comedy. Again, why a top choice, Kevin?
It's one of my. I have two choices. One is Molesworth, which is my pleasurable choice, and then I have Dante, which is my serious choice. And Dante, because it's a very short poem. You could actually read the damn thing in about a day. The damn thing. That was absolutely unintentional. And yet, you know, you can spend a lifetime reading it and you don't exhaust it. It's, as a friend of mine used to say, like a multi-story car park, it operates on many levels. So you can read it simply for the story, which is a damned gripping story, again, or you can read it for, you know, the various levels of sort of intellectual debate which take part in it. And it's very beautiful and very frightening.
Midway upon the journey of our life, I found myself within a forest dark, for the straightforward pathway had been lost. Ah me, how hard a thing it is to say what was this forest savage, rough and stern, which in the very thought renews the fear. So bitter is it, death is little more, but of the good to treat which there I found, speak will I of the other things I saw there. I did do it at Italian A level, and the sound is rather beautiful, but it refers all the time to sort of people who were prominent in 14th century Italy, who you've got to look up the footnotes for to know what they were about.
It's quite staggeringly violent at times as well, isn't it? You know, that the number of mutilations, I mean, the character Bertrand de Born, who walks around holding his own head, which he shouts out at, for example, is pretty memorable. And there's also people being disemboweled and bathing in blood, and there are rains of what I think I politely could call excrement. It's a chamber of horrors.
I think people choose it because they feel rather glad that they're slightly in a better place.
But is it the sort of book, I mean, it's a bit like Silence of the Lambs, which I know was chosen as well. Is it the sort of book that you'd want to read when you're stuck in a remote, barren place, alone, Tim?
As you reach your twilight years, I think you feel you'd rather read things that you know are good, that history or posterity has told you that's good, not posterity, what's the opposite of that? Anyway, books that you know are almost certainly going to be brilliant because they've survived, rather than take a punt on something which might be great, but, you know, I mean, I haven't got time to listen to brilliant current pop singers like Jessie J with any great detail, because I'd rather listen to the Everly Brothers again, you know, because I know they're good. I haven't got much time left to get into new people.
Come.
Although I do like Jessie J.
Are there surprising absences from the list, Kevin?
There's not much poetry. I sort of expected rather more. And what poetry does come up is fairly conventional. I was kind of surprised that more people didn't choose Philip Larkin, who I think is, you know, usually considered one of the best loved poets, if not the best poets of the last century. People who chose T.S. Eliot, who was supposedly, according to the BBC poll, our favourite poet of the 20th century, is only represented a few times by four quartets rather than by the entire body of work. And the entire body of work is only about 200 pages, so you felt they were being a bit sort of self-limiting.
I'm surprised there's so few contemporary novels as well, or novels by living authors.
It's very interesting, that point, because there's an awful lot of music is chosen by people who are still alive. And I remember when I was doing it, choosing, you know, one or two pop records, and sometimes by people I knew. One would think, I've got to have a record by this artist because they'll be terribly offended if I don't have them. They couldn't give us stuff, frankly, because they wouldn't hear the programme.
You mentioned a love of maths earlier, and composer John Rutter chose Teach Yourself Mathematics, illustrated by voluptuous women. Slightly beggars belief.
Really?
Would that be your ideal choice, then?
Well, I haven't read that particular book.
I'm not sure he read it either.
I do like books on numbers and mathematics. I mean, I'm a bit of an anorak, really. I mean, most of my interests in life, like cricket and astronomy, have emerged from, you know, liking numbers. I do find there's a great beauty in mathematics, because mathematics exists. If man didn't exist, mathematics would. Pi would still be 3.14159, even if we weren't here.
Let's see an example, Harriet, of the sort of thing Tim would consider now to be really unputdownable.
Okay. A laugh a minute, this one.
Tim, this is for you, all right. It follows from the definition of perfection that the sum of reciprocals of the divisors of a perfect number is 2. For example, since 28 plus 28 equals 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 7 plus 14 plus 28. We can divide through by 28 and obtain 2 equals 1 28th plus 1 14th plus 1 7th plus 1 quarter plus half plus 1.
Well, that was from the Penguin Book of Curious and Interesting Numbers by David Wells, and it was about the number 28, in case you hadn't guessed. Is it a good example, though, Kevin, of something that we should take heart from, which is the sort of human striving for betterment, as it were, that there are a lot of books on this list that are all about people wanting to achieve something, to better themselves, to use this time constructively?
I mean, I think the basic idea of the book is to say something about your own personality, really, isn't it? It's a book that's meant a lot to you, or a book that says something about what you basically are in your imagination. But a lot of people are self-improvers, and I think that's a very good thing.
And if it is about showing your personality, what does it say about you two gentlemen, both of whom would have chosen Molesworth? I'll give you first voice on this, Tim.
Well, I suppose in my case, Molesworth, again, was something from my childhood. And I think, again, the older you get, the more you look back on things that you loved in your childhood, because you were certain that you loved them when you were a kid. And then you grow up, and you're not certain that you really love the things you think you do. But when you get, you know, a little bit older, you think, hang on, I know I love that. I know I loved astronomy. I know I love the planet Saturn. I know I love Nigel Molesworth. And also, as it happens, Molesworth is a brilliant book. He's a great philosopher, Nigel Molesworth. He's up there with, you know, Popper and Wittgenstein. He really has a great view on life in the 50s for a young person. And it's very funny, very witty.
There are also, actually, Kevin, I mean, I want to know why you chose Molesworth as well, but there's also very few funny books on the list. And actually, one of the things you'd think there'd be a dearth of on the island would be laughter, because it's quite hard to make yourself laugh.
There are a few books. I mean, there are things which, Three Men in a Boat was, I think, chosen by Vic Reeves. A very charming book, which, you know, has that quality of idyll and paradise about it as well. Wind in the Willows is not exactly a funny book, although it does have very nice humorous passages. That's quite popular.
It's more whimsical, isn't it?
Yeah, some Dickens novels. Obviously, there's a lot of wonderful humor in Dickens, like we were talking earlier about the passage in Great Expectations where Mr. Wopsle plays Hamlet, which has made me cry with laughter.
Winnie the Pooh?
Winnie the Pooh,
yes.
Yeah,
Woodhouse,
like that kind
there,
of, Woodhouse is quite popular.
Yeah.
It's quite popular. But books that make you laugh out loud, I think, are rare and to be treasured. And Molesworth, for me, not only do you have the fantastically timed prose of Geoffrey Willans, a great genius of prose writing by anybody's standards, but you have the magnificent cartoons of Ronald Searle, which are, so you have two for the price of one. You get brilliant prose and brilliant sketches. So I think it's a cheat, but it's very, very rich.
Well, we can't bring you Searle's drawings on radio, sadly, but we can bring you a passage from Molesworth. Harriet, if you would.
We can't bring you the spelling either, but I shall enjoy that while I read it. Visiting the school. The day the parents come means much activity at the school. All rude drawings and propaganda, down with the mallmongers, meeting at Dalston Friday, are wiped off blackboards. School dog is muzzled, boys wash their necks, and the bath is cleaned. Next, masters are let out of their cells in new suits, mashers, ties, etc., and are forced by the headmaster to toe party line. Have you been guilty of imperialist dogma in break by pinching a boy's cup of cocoa? I have. Have you practiced sabotage against the school piano by cutting wires so that low C sounds plunk? I have. Do you admit this led to subversive singing of Jiken John Plunk in his Plunk So Gay? I do. Do you further admit to placing three tin ashtrays on the top of the said piano? I do. So that class sing Jia Tinkle Plunk John Plunk Tinkle in his Tinkle Tinkle Zing? They did. Were you also a tool of Wall Street by interfering with the metronome while music mistress was singing Trees at the school concert? I was. Did you express the view that even if the music mistress was a tree, you would not like her planted in your garden? Yes. Who invented the first railway engine? Stalin.
One of the things that's wonderful about that, and partly it's just the beautiful comic timing of it, I think, a wonderful placing of words, and the spelling, of course, is a joy in its own right. But of course, at one level, it's actually a satire, you know, not only of a minor public school, but it's about the Moscow show trials. You know, it's all this stuff about Stalin and the steam engine, show trials, the stuff about CND, down with the warmongers, meeting doors on Friday. It's, the jokes are very much about the grown-up world as well as the child world.
Are you sure you're not just trying to add hidden depth to our image of you,
Kevin? I have to say that there is, of course, although Tim has unfairly described Nigel as no intellectual, he has a very good chapter about Proust.
A great philosopher,
but before then the books aren't terribly intellectual. There's a wonderful chapter about Proust, do you remember, where Nigel pretends to the headmaster Grimes that he's been reading Swan's Way, which finally ends with Grimes saying, "Silence, boy, there is no such book."
Yes. This is in danger of turning into the Molesworth fan club. Thank you all very much indeed. I'm afraid that's where our time runs out. Thanks very much to our guests, Tim Rice, Kevin Jackson, and Harriet Walter, and all the past castaways whose book choices we've been scrutinising. Enjoy the rest of tonight's prom.
Mariella Frostrup presented this evening's Proms Plus Literary event, and the producer was Allegra McElroy. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and part two of this particularly unusual prom, marking 7 decades of the Radio 4 programme Desert Island Discs. So far, we've heard the musical choices of castaways, including Sir David Attenborough and Darcy Bustle. The BBC Concert Orchestra is providing the music, sometimes on their own, sometimes accompanying the Huddersfield Choral Society, or distinguished soloists, some of whom have been castaways themselves. Kirsty Young will be meeting plenty more castaways between now and the end of the concert. And the Desert Island Discs team is hosting a live blog where you can share your Desert Island choices and talk about the prom as it happens. You can find the blog by visiting the Radio 4 homepage or visit the prom's homepage at bbc.co.uk/proms and follow the links. And that applause is for Principal Conductor Keith Lockhart returning to the platform to start the second half of the prom with another theme I think you'll recognise.
Well, Simon West Newby, I do feel as if we should have jogged on to that, but I can't quite manage it in these heels. Welcome to Desert Island Discs at the Proms. It is wonderful to have you here, Falklands war veteran and a very well-known man, clearly, in this auditorium. Last week, you marked the Cardiff Festival by lighting the Olympic torch for the Paralympics. Now, that must have been a pretty special moment.
It was immense. It was something that not many people are going to get a chance to do, not in this country. There's only 4 to do it in the evening like that. But it was an immensely proud moment for me. I have a huge respect for Paralympians. You know, they've overcome nature and man-made adversity, and they go on to achieve so brilliantly, and we watch them now and see how they achieve. They're just so inspirational.
You yourself... You yourself have faced a good deal of man-made adversity, to use your phrase. It was on the Sir Galahad in 1982 that you met with great trauma and horror. I'm wondering, coming on to a program like Desert Island Discs, where you talk on the public stage about something that is incredibly intimate and personal, why did you make a decision to do that, and what effect did it have?
Sometimes you can live with your own ghosts for far too long. And it's nice to be able to get it out. And other people then understand. You know, people see you and they see you on TV, but they only get to see a short clip. And sometimes it's nice just to express yourself in your own words, and so that other people understand exactly who you are and what you've been through. But not just you, because you're almost, to take the earlier part of the conversation, you're almost a torchbearer for those who served with you and those who didn't come home. You know, so it's important. And I think it's important that people don't forget the sacrifice and the service that so many make, and all those ones who don't come home, and the families that are bereaved, you know, that they are remembered as well.
I should mention to people we came on there to Barry Stoller's Offside, which was one of the pieces that you chose from Match of the Day, of course. We're going to hear one of your other choices a little later on. But for now, Simon, a great inspiration to so many people, very clear from the applause. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Well, our next castaway tonight was once voted the nation's favourite actress. She is Patricia Routledge. Patricia, can I welcome you, please, on stage? Thank you for coming. So many endless cheers. We are spoiling you tonight. I hope you appreciate this. Patricia, you've been cast away twice on Desert Island Discs, and on both occasions, I understand you took, was it tea-making facilities and a selection of teas?
Yes, indeed.
Tell me about that.
Yes. Two china cups and saucers, a silver tea set, and every known kind of tea and tisane. Two cups and saucers for when somebody flies in to collect me. And I shall serve it in a large picture hat, a floral dress, and gloves. Because, of course, appearances have to be kept up.
I should just check. Was there builder's tea in there as well, just in case you wanted...
No, not at my address.
I thought not. Now, you're a lover not just of tea, but of poetry too. You've taken with you various an anthology of poetry and the collected works of
yes.
John Donne.
Yes.
It's pianistic poetry, really, that we're going to hear tonight as one of your choices. Just explain a little bit about what we're going to hear and why you chose it for discs.
It's a glorious piece. I love the piano. Beethoven loved the piano, and with this gloriously affirmative generosity of music, it would take me through any kind of lows or highs.
Patricia Routledge, CBE, thank you very much for joining us this evening. Thank you. Well, I should tell you that the soloist, who is about to join the BBC Concert Orchestra, also chose the piece he's about to play when he was cast away. That was in 1988. It is Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, and here to play the first movement with the BBC Concert Orchestra and Keith Lockhart is Peter Donohoe.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Magnificent. Peter Donohoe was the soloist in the first movement of Beethoven's fifth piano concerto, the Emperor Concerto. Keith Lockhart conducted the BBC Concert Orchestra, and I'm wondering if Peter Donohoe is off for a lie down now, because I can secretly tell you that his luxury was a waterbed. 185 castaways have chosen pianos, but Peter Lockhart wasn't... Peter Donohoe, rather, wasn't one of them. Now, the stage crew behind me are about to remove this piano, and as they do that, I would like to welcome onto the stage here, John Sessions.
I really must confess, Mr. Plumley, that you strike a somewhat different figure from what I had expected. The luxuriant blonde hair and the rather fetching, one might almost say feminine, clothing that does you no little justice, I have to say.
How are you?
I'm very well. I don't know if you've already helped yourself to the hospitality, but I'm hoping we'll get through the next few minutes. 20-odd years ago that you were cast away, and when you were at the time, as you were introduced, you said, you know, I'm one of those people that it's very difficult to classify. Is it any easier, do you think, to classify you?
That's being a rather pretentious idiot, I think. I think I'm an actor. I like people applauding, and I don't like it when they don't applaud.
Right.
So I'm pretty straightforward, I think. Well, that's very nice of you people. Yeah.
I often find that on Desert Island Disc, when I speak to actors and actresses, they are the people who more than anybody else have imagined themselves in the circumstances of actually trying to live and survive on a desert island. Uh-huh. Now, you are in the position of actually, you appeared in a film called Castaway.
I was in a film called Castaway with the late great, and he was great in many ways, Oliver Reed.
Yes.
Did you know that Oliver Reed actually topped Sean Connery as the top British box office draw in 1969. Anyway, we did this film, very quick, Kirsty, but we did a film together, this Castaway, and I had to play his best man, and scenes with Oliver Reed chucking lager over my head and lots of nonsense like that. Anyway, I was also doing Spitting Image at the time, and myself and one of my colleagues had just done a sketch the night before where we'd done Peter O'Toole and Oliver Reed. One had the legs chopped off, and the other one had a sex change for a bet. Peter O'Toole's line was, "I used to be Peter O'Toole, now I'm Peter No-Toole." Anyway, so the director was a chap called Nicholas Rogue, a very distinguished director, and his boy was one of the runners on it, just a young lad who makes the actors cups of tea and things. And he told Ollie that I'd done him the night before on television. So I was in the makeup trailer, and there's a mirror in front of me with lots of light bulbs around it. And Ollie came in, his great bullfrog head came down next to me. It was rather like that scene in Jurassic Park when the Tyrannosaurus Rex looks into the car, and he got hold of my head and started spinning it. And I thought, he's going to put my head right through the mirror. And he went, "You're a funny little Herbert, aren't you?"
We could listen to you all night, but we do have to get on to the music.
Yeah. We're running late, by the way.
We are actually running very late. Yeah. We're going to choose not your favoured disc, not the one you'd save from the waves. That was a bit of Mahler. But tonight we're going to hear some Puccini.
Absolutely.
Opera is a big, important
love
part
opera.
Of the, yes.
I go to lots of opera. I absolutely adore it. And very recently I saw the Otello at the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden. I don't know if anyone's seen it. It's absolutely wonderful. It's one of the best productions I've ever seen. Thank you. Well clapped, madam. And sir. Or is it sir? It was just the colour of that dress. That was all right. Yes, so I'm a big fan of... Funny, I've grown into Verdi. Like a lot of people, I came to Puccini very quickly. I mean, a lot of people are very snobbish about Puccini. Somebody called Tosca a shoddy little shocker. I can't remember who. But I love it. It's 90 minutes long. It goes straight to the point. And the aria I wish to hear, which Kirsty is alluding to... Vice d'arte, vice d'amore, is I live for art, I live for love. And it's once again a beautiful woman being given the sharp end by an absolute bastard, Scarpia. And it's my favorite, it's probably my favorite aria.
And on that note, John Sessions, we will say thank you very much. Anyway. Thank you. So we are, in fact, going to hear two arias by Puccini, Visi d'Arte, I Lived for Art, and Un Bel Dì, One Fine Day. And to take the roles of Tosca and Madame Butterfly this evening, we have an irrepressible Irish soprano. She has had a fascinating career that's taken her to opera houses and concert halls all over the world, and yet somehow she's managed to stay fresh and untainted by the trappings of success. Ladies and gentlemen, she is Eilish Tynan. So thank you very much there to Eilish for Ambaldi from Madame Butterfly and Visi d'Arte from Tosca, those two Puccini arias that she performed there. And thank you too to the BBC Concert Orchestra conducted by Keith Lockhart. So in the course of the evening, we have clearly been able to meet just a tiny fraction of the 3,000 people who featured as castaways on Desert Island Discs. And you can find out what music every castaway chose by going online to the programme's website on the Radio 4 homepage. You can also hear around 1,500 of the actual programmes now online. They make compelling listening, both for the human stories and, of course, for the wide selection of wonderful music. So to capture a flavour of the range of songs that are featured on the programme, David Chase has arranged the top 8 requested pop songs in Desert Island Discs history, and he's woven them into a piece specially commissioned for tonight's prom. It's orchestrated by Bill Elliott, and there's a chance for all of us to join in with the final number tonight, because that is my way. Before that, we are going to hear Mad Dogs and Englishmen, Over the Rainbow, La Vie en Rose, What a Wonderful World, Imagine, Underneath the Arches, and Je ne regrette rien. So, let's welcome back, what a selection, let's welcome back Eilish Tynan and Bryn Terfel, together with Simon Butteris, Anna J. Casey, and the Huddersfield Choral Society, to join the BBC Concert Orchestra and Keith Lockhart in the world premiere of Desert Island Hits. We'll be right back.
tropical climes and certain times of day. When all the citizens retire to take their clothes off and perspire, it's one of those rules that the greatest fools obey. Because the sun is far too sultry and one must avoid its ultraviolet ray. The natives grieve when the white men leave their huts, because they're obviously, definitely nuts. And dogs and Englishmen go out in midday sun. The Japanese don't care to, the Chinese wouldn't dare to. Hindus and Argentines keep firmly from 12 to 1. But Englishmen detest our siesta. In the Philippines, they have lovely screens to protect you from the glare. In the Malay States, they're hats like face which the Britishers won't wear. At 12 of noon, the date is full, and no further work is done. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in midday sun. Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in midday sun. The smallest Malay rabbit deplores this foolish habit. In Hong Kong, they strike a gong and fire off a noonday gun to reprimand each inmate who's in late. In the mangrove swamps where the python romps, there's peace from 12 to 2. Even caribous lie around and snooze, for there's nothing else to do. In Bengal, to move at all is seldom, if ever, done. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday. 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 Out in the midday.
Of the rainbow really in the sky are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, clouds of white, the bright blessed days, the dark sacred nights, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I think to
Car ma vie, car mes choix.
you.
But then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do and saw it through without exemption.
I planned each charted course, each careful step along the byway.
I think you liked that, didn't you? So that was then the world premiere of Desert Island Hits, arranged by David Chase, orchestrated by Bill Elliott, and performed there by Eilish Tynan, Anna J. Casey, Simon Butteris, Bryn Terfel, the Huddersfield Choral Society, the BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by Keith Lockhart, and all of you, too. Well done. So, that brings us very nearly to the end of this very special prom, celebrating 70 years of Desert Island Discs. A huge thank you to all the castaways who've joined me on stage this evening, and of course to all our performers. Those categories, of course, have sometimes overlapped. I'm Kirsty Young, and over the next few weeks, I'll be sharpening those gramophone needles ready for the next series of Desert Island Discs. The programme is back on air on the 23rd of September, and I do hope that you will all join me then. But just before we go, we're not the only ones who've been celebrating this year. The BBC Concert Orchestra is 60 this year. So, the final choice of music. And they don't look a day over 55, I would say. Anyway, the final choice of music tonight is theirs. We started the prom with, of course, the Desert Island Discs theme tune by The Sleepy Lagoon. That was composed by Eric Coates. And he also wrote the music that over the years has become the concert orchestra's signature piece, his Dam Busters March. Keith Lockhart, chalks away. Thank you.
the Dambusters March by Eric Coates. Keith Lockhart conducting the BBC Concert Orchestra, led tonight by Charles Mutter. As Kirsty Young said, they're celebrating their 60th anniversary this year. Since 1952, the orchestra's been the house orchestra for Radio 2's Friday Night is Music Night. It gives regular broadcasts, of course, on Radio 3. And tonight, it's been helping Radio 4 celebrate one of their longest-running programmes. Keith Lockhart was appointed principal conductor in 2010. He's also music director of the Boston Pops, a position he's held since 1995. And both those orchestras have been requested by castaways on Desert Island Discs over the years. Keith Lockhart returning to the stage with the soloists we heard performing in Desert Island Hits. Simon Buttress not making his debut at the Proms, incidentally, a seasoned Proms performer. Anna Jane Casey, Elish Tynan, and Bryn Terville. Behind them, getting to their feet now, are the Huddersfield Choral Society. The society celebrated its 175th anniversary last year. Their chorus master is Joseph Cullen. And Kirsty Young also taking a bow on stage as this Desert Island Discs anniversary prom comes to a close. From the Royal Albert Hall, it's good night from me. I'll hand you back to John Shea.
Thank you very much to Louise Fryer there presenting tonight's prom, and we'll be back at the Royal Albert Hall tomorrow evening when David Robertson will be conducting the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra in music by Brahms, Beethoven, Schoenberg and Gershwin tomorrow night at the usual time of 7:30. This is BBC Radio 3 at the not very usual time of 23 minutes past 10. I'm afraid we're running quite late because of tonight's live prom. Apologies for that. The essay, the first of this week's programmes, will now be on the air a little before 10 past 11, and it'll be followed by tonight's Jazz on 3 at just before 25 past 11. Before that, time for the last programme in this summer's series of the Lebrecht interview. Here's Norman Lebrecht to introduce this evening's guest.
John Adams is one of the most successful composers alive today, certainly the most successful opera composer. Some would say the most controversial. His breakthrough work, Nixon in China, broke an age-old American convention of discretion and reverence for living presidents. His second opera, The Death of Klinghoffer, showed the terrorist murder of a disabled man. Recently, Dr. Atomic raised unsettling questions about the nuclear debate. Adams has been attacked by successive chief critics on the New York Times as insubstantial and seriously limited. Yet, his works have entered standard repertory, and they show new dimensions with each new production. An East Coaster who moved to San Francisco, John Coolidge Adams started composing at the age of 10 and heard his music performed before he started shaving. At first a minimalist with such titles as Common Tones in Simple Time, he worked tonally outwards to find a style that is melodic, emotional and intellectually stimulating. Batter My Heart from Dr. Atomic is the most arresting curtain aria in years. Politically liberal, Adams says he's been followed by US Secret Services and blacklisted by the Homeland Security Department. He's in London to conduct at the Proms, and we meet up in a BBC studio. John Adams, you got through immigration without difficulty?
Yes, I did. And I think perhaps blacklisted was a choice of words that we were all throwing around back 10 years ago. But I was for several years on a watch list, but it's a list that you don't know about, and you know you're on it, but there's no explanation of why.
Well, how do you know you're on it?
You know you're on it because when you go to check in, there are always minor difficulties. But Ted Kennedy, the great senator, was also on it, so it's possible that my very, very familiar American name is just one that may have rung bells.
Well, it might have been another John Adams, or it could have been a dead president.
It could have been a dead president, or because of various newspaper articles that had my name with them and the Achille Lauro or terrorism or something like that, that it rang some bells.
But, were you disturbed by that?
I was annoyed by it because it's really very tedious.
What do? You pick up a phone and ring your senator?
I actually did speak to my senator, and she was appalled.
But she's
California. Also head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, so I think that helped to get me off it.
Right. Did you feel harassed?
No, I think that, you know, after 2001, and particularly after the initiation of the Iraq War, that those of us who disagreed with the right wing and with Bush did feel put upon, because it was one of those you're either against us or you're with us type of attitudes. And it brought me back in certain ways to the Vietnam War when I was a teenager. But, you know, it's just kind of in the tenor of the times these days, particularly in the U.S., that the political debate is so toxic.
You grew up in what reads like a John Updike setting in your memoir. Small town Vermont and New Hampshire. Your mother, a singer in amateur musicals. No television in the house. Idyllic in its rural simplicities. Was it like that?
I think so. You know, it's difficult when you tell your life story, as I've done. I wrote an autobiography or memoir or whatever you want to call it, Hallelujah Junction. There's always a danger to create a narrative from your memory, and then you repeat it so often that it becomes a truth, I say, with quotation marks around it. And maybe my childhood wasn't as idyllic as I think it was, but I seemed to, even while I was living it, I was aware of it. You know, I discovered Charles Ives when I was about 12, I think. Leonard Bernstein recorded the Second Symphony, and up to that point, Ives was a completely unknown composer in most of the country. And I was aware of how similar my childhood was to Ives. And I was also aware that I was somewhat a loner. I wasn't in any way misanthropic. I liked other kids, and I spent time with them, but I was kind of obsessed with music, and I had this very rich, imaginative life where I already had written all these pieces, these symphonies and ballets and concertos. And
did they actually exist in your head, or were they?
They did.
They were just opus numbers.
They had opus numbers, and I could hum the tunes for you if you had run into me in those days. I had a paper route. Mm-hmm. I lived in a very small village in New Hampshire, and I remember that I'd go around, do the paper route, and the paper route took about 45 minutes, so most of my pieces were 45 minutes long.
Your father played clarinet, and so that became your instrument.
That's right. We didn't have a piano in the house. Neither my parents played, although they were both musical. I think my mother was probably the more natural musical talent. She was a wonderful singer, and she sang Broadway tunes and acted in a local theater company, but she had absolutely no musical training. And for both of my parents, the idea of getting me solidly grounded in music, my father taught me the clarinet, and then
You played in bands.
I played in bands, but I started exhibiting tendencies towards creativity when I was very young, and my parents, God bless them, they saw this, and they...
How did they see it?
I think that they were both people who loved the arts, and neither of them had graduated from college, but they had previously lived in a small village in Vermont that was full of very intellectual refugees from New York and Boston, most of them Jewish. Many of them were left-wing people who had been chased out during the McCarthy era. And it was from these people that I was exposed, for example, to Stravinsky and to Mozart and Beethoven and Tchaikovsky. And so my parents were keen enough to realize that they should find me somebody to teach me counterpoint and harmony.
At what age?
I think I probably took my first lesson when I was about 10 or 12 or so. And I started writing melodies and then started studying harmony. And as I tell this tale in my book, the first orchestra that I played in was sponsored by the New Hampshire State Mental Hospital. And we would rehearse on, I think, every Monday night, and then a couple of times a year give a concert. And the concert was, we usually have a light classic piece, like, I don't know, 1812 overture or unfinished symphony or movement from a Mozart symphony, and then maybe Sound of Music or theme songs from Oklahoma, and would always end with a march. And the audience was a room full of severely disturbed mental patients. And these were probably in the years before most patients like this were just controlled with drugs. So these patients showed their emotions, and they showed them immediately while cheering and yelling or breaking into tears at the first sound of music. So it was a very primal experience for me to understand how immensely powerful music's essence is. And I think at that early age, I realized that music is about feeling. And this is interesting because, of course, a few years later, I end up in college at Harvard University, and it's the 60s, and it's the period when feeling is being chased out of the musical experience, and it's all intellect. So it took me a while to come around and realize the importance of that lesson I learned there in that hall in the mental hospital.
Describe the sensation of hearing your own music performed for the first time. You were, what, 13, 14?
Yes. Well, I think the principal thing was that I had composed this piece. It was a suite for string orchestra. And the thing that I remember more than anything was how out of tune it was. I had to get over the fact that amateur string players sounded so sour. I don't really recall whether I was thrilled with the sound of my own music, but it obviously stimulated me to keep on doing it.
Did your parents make a comment?
Oh, they were thrilled. I mean, wouldn't you be? I have two very talented children myself. They're not children anymore. One's a composer who just had his third orchestra piece premiered by Michael Tilson Thomas, and a daughter who's a very gifted painter. And I know that feeling of being a parent and seeing a young kid and identifying their talent and fostering it. It's just such a key thing to be able to do.
So then you go on to Harvard, Ivory Towers, and the austere...
I beg your pardon. Harvard was no ivory tower in the late 1960s. It was combat zone, okay. Cultural combat zone.
Well, cultural and political.
Yes, of course, you know.
And you go into the class of the composer Leon Kirchner, who says you've got to write like Schoenberg or nobody will take you seriously. Was that about right?
No, that's not quite right. I think that Leon was an exception. The most influential figure in the academy during those years was Milton Babbitt, whom I later met and found to be an absolutely lovely guy with a great, wicked sense of humor. My teacher, Leon Kirchner, had been a student of Schoenberg's, and he was, he was a real musician. He spent his summers at the Marlboro Music Festival and conducted with Rudolf Serkin and Alexander Schneider, and he was really part of that great tradition of first-generation Europeans who brought the great principles of Schnabel and Casals and Schoenberg. And Leon was not your sort of garden variety, cloistered college academic. In fact, he was really a fish out of water in the university. But he was immensely intelligent. And I think he was immensely unhappy with what had happened to music. And his own music is this white-hot romanticism that's kind of caught in this unhappy straitjacket of, the kind of atonality that one felt was necessary to write in the 1960s. There is a tension that's never resolved, and I think that tension was something that I picked up on and I rebelled against. And, of course, at the same time that students were all worried about Webern and Boulez and Stockhausen, you'd walk out of the very quiet classrooms of the music department and walk across Harvard Yard and and hear the Rolling Stones or Jimi Hendrix pouring out of the dorm windows, and there was Dionysus for you.
And you were tempted?
It wasn't a question of being tempted. I was enchanted by it, and I was thoroughly a child of the times. I love that music, and I listened to it, and I knew it as well as anyone else.
Politically, you went on marches?
I did. I don't think I was any different than most of the kids. I mean, if I can say it on the BBC, our asses were in a sling. All of us who were males were all looking at getting sent to Vietnam, and it was a question of how to get out of it. So, of course, you know, I marched in several large protests, and at one point I was chased down Massachusetts Avenue by a Cambridge cop wielding a club, and got a true taste of the class divide. That was 1971, I think, 70 or 71, and it was a very exciting time. It was also a very troubling time. I mean, we really wanted this to be over. Mm. The country was rent in a way that it's never been in my lifetime, probably not since the McCarthy era. And I decided I wanted to get away from where I'd grown up and from the East Coast, so I got in a car and drove across the country to California.
One of the things that took you across the country, that took you west, was this discovery of minimalism, Terry Riley, and so forth. Was that the attraction, to go to a music that was as different as possible from the austerity that was being preached at Harvard?
I cannot exactly remember whether music was the initial impulse for my decision. I had been reading a lot of beat literature. I'd been reading Jack Kerouac, and there's a great book by Henry Miller, author of Tropic of Cancer, called Big Sur and the Oranges of Hieronymus Bosch, which describes 7 years of his life living after he returned from living in Europe. He went and he lived in a tiny hamlet of artists up on the cliffs overlooking the Pacific. And I think I was drawn by that romantic idea. I'd just never been out in New England. I'd never been to Europe. I'd never been anywhere. But I did know that there were great rock bands out there, and it was a different kind of life. I just wanted to see what it was like. I didn't have any inkling that I would spend the rest of my life there.
Hotel California.
That's right.
The music itself. Yeah. You've never wanted to be called minimalist.
No, well, I rejected the term for myself. Right. Actually, there was a 4 or 5 year period where I was not that cognizant of minimalism. I was a real acolyte of John Cage, and the first concerts that I produced with my students out in California, I mean, there's a chapter missing that I haven't discussed about just how I lived hand to mouth when I first got out to California, working on the waterfront in Oakland, and
you were doing pretty menial jobs.
Yeah, but it was a good experience. And I actually was probably one of the few composers who could actually talk to Cornelius Carter when I finally met him about being a working class guy. But I did eventually start teaching at this very small school, the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. And one of my assignments was to produce new music concerts. So I knew all my John Cage very well, and I was very deeply imbued in John's orthodoxy. And I do think that Cage is a very orthodox composer. That surprises people because they think of him as an iconoclast, but he actually is a strangely intolerant composer in a certain way when it comes to anything that doesn't fit into his very precise world. Mm. And that means most of Western music, whether it's Miles Davis or Beethoven. You know, eventually I just had to throw that out because I had fun doing John Cage, and you could talk about it forever. But, you know, my background and my musical breeding had brought me up to love great music. And also, I keep going back to this experience about knowing that music is essentially the art of feeling. And Cage had no place in that. So when I did hear my first minimalist pieces, I was thrilled. I think the first one I heard live was Drumming by Steve Reich. And I was really thrilled because here was something that was aurally beautiful. It was sensuous on a sound level. It had musical structure. It had development. And it had a beat, which was something that had been missing from contemporary music for so long.
And yet the first piece that you write that actually makes an impact, you've written quite a few pieces before then, but the one possibly the orchestral breakthrough piece was Harmonielehre, which takes its title and idea from Schoenberg. So you've gone back to the other extreme.
Well, actually, Harmonielehre was about a fifth or sixth piece in a growth period for me. I think the most important first work that I did was a piano piece called Phrygian Gates, which is clearly minimalist, but also exhibits such a kind of explosive energy to break the kind of minimalist straitjacket. And that was followed by a piece called Shaker Loops, which is still done a great deal today. It's probably one of my most popular pieces. Harmonielehre came about 8 or 9 years later. And that was a piece that was, it was kind of a whimsical piece because I'd had a commission to write a large work for symphony orchestra. And I had been reading Schoenberg's textbook on harmony. And I got this crazy idea of taking the language that Schoenberg was renouncing, which is the kind of fin du siècle language we hear in, I don't know, in Mahler's Tenth, for example, or in Pelléas or Gurlieder, and then mixing it with minimalist principles. It was a crazy idea, but it worked.
Another paradox. Going to California, instead of being totally laid back and hanging out, you become immersed in German literature and philosophy, and you mix, I think you once told me, all of your friends are academics. You live in quite a high-minded community.
I live in Berkeley, California. I don't teach there, but I live there. And yes, I mean, some of our friends are Nobel Prize winners and brilliant chemists and physicists and historians, but that, not all of our friends are like that. What's curious, though, and upsetting to me, is that even amongst people as brilliant as that, how few of them listen to classical music. I would say that scientists do listen to classical music. But, for example, you know, we live on a fairly small street. Everyone on the street knows each other. And everyone knows I'm a composer, but they wouldn't know my music if they heard it because they listen to the Gypsy Kings or they listen to 70s rock or 60s rock if they're in their 50s or so. And it's a measure of just how in American society classical music has just gradually become smaller and smaller in terms of its reach. Part of this I attribute to the enormous influence of popular music and the radio and now, of course, listening to music online. But it's also, I think, a very sad result of the fact that classical music is just not valued. For example, you couldn't possibly run for president of the United States and come out and say that you loved Mahler. You'd be ridiculed.
You'd be loved.
It would be like, you know, when John Kerry, you know, he spoke apparently perfect French because he'd gone to school in Switzerland at some point, and he had to conceal that when he ran for president. So it's partly an anti-intellectual thing, which has a great history in the United States. I mean, you can read about it in Martin Chuzzlewit. But I think it's also the fact that kids don't listen to classical music when they're kids. When they're young, they don't play musical instruments at the level that we played them in.